This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Hi, and welcome to The Long View. I'm Jeff Patak, Global Director of Manager Research for Morningstar Research Services.
And I'm Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance for Morningstar.
Our guest on the podcast today is author Brian Portnoy. Brian has written two books on the field of behavioral finance, The Investor's Paradox and The Geometry of Wealth. He's also the editor of a forthcoming book of essays about how financial experts invest their own money called How I Invest My Money. Brian is the founder of Shaping Wealth, a financial wellness platform that works with individuals and organizations to make better money decisions. For more than two decades, Brian has worked in the hedge fund and mutual fund industries as portfolio manager and educator. He was also our colleague at Morningstar in the early 2000s. He's a CFA charter holder and earned his doctorate at the University of Chicago. Brian, welcome to The Long View.
Good to be here.
You've co-edited a new book with Josh Brown of Ritholtz Wealth Management. These are essays from financial experts about how they invest their own money. You also contributed your own essay, as did Josh, as did Christine, as a matter of fact. So what made you and Josh want to put together the book? What was the inspiration for it?
So Josh published a blog maybe a year and a half ago with the title like How I Invest My Own Money. And what he pointed out that I thought was interesting was that for as many years as he's been in the business, no one's really asked him that question. And so he decided to reveal kind of how he invests and spends and borrows. And I just thought it was revealing. It was raw. Josh is a really insightful guy. And, you know, I reached out to him. We're friends. And I said, you know, this is something that everybody in the industry should do. If you're an advisor or an educator or a portfolio manager, you know, figuring out or being able to articulate your money story is probably not only a healthy experience, it's probably beneficial to your clients and your community. So we developed that idea, and Harriman House, which has become sort of the publishing arm of financial Twitter, loved the idea, and they gave us a book contract. So we went and tapped in total 25 people, including me, Josh, and Christine, to write personal essays, just 4 or 5 pages, nothing too elaborate, but blank piece of paper. How do you save, spend, invest, borrow? And what we got back was pretty impressive. I think I have high standards for books, and this one really exceeded my expectations.
So as these essays started to roll in, were there any things that surprised you about what your fellow experts were doing with their money? Were there any sort of recurrent themes, and especially things that were surprising?
Yeah, and I can't wait for everybody to see the volume. I mean, these are 25 pretty different stories. I mean, I guess everybody has ended up in financial services, whether it be managing portfolios or working with clients. But, you know, I'll give a couple examples, like Bob Seawright, who's, you know, a friend of all of ours and a wonderful man and very articulate. He spent his entire essay talking about a lake cottage that has been in his family for multiple generations. He didn't get into portfolio diversification or what funds he chose. It was just a story about the money they've invested over the years into something that's really meaningful. On a completely different note, Desarte Yarnway, who's one of the, I think, young rising stars of the wealth management industry, talked about his family's emigration from Africa to the United States and how he thinks about community and how money fits into him being able to help others. So, you know, lots of people in some way, shape, or form talked about their retirement accounts, whether or not they might, you know, still have a mortgage on their home and stocks they might like and things like that. But I think the real color and flavor of the book comes through these personal stories, and we've got 25 of them.
Yeah, you alluded before to the fact that it's a very diverse collection of stories reflecting different perspectives, but there's also some commonalities among the essays. Like a few that come to mind is how often freedom and independence are cited as maybe some of the, I guess, animating principles behind how it is some of your contributors invest. What else did you observe as you were assembling the collection?
Yeah, so it's an important observation. So on the one hand, the quest for independence, the ability to afford, you know, the life that you want to live, that theme did course through a number of the chapters. But, you know, what was also interesting was that people described that in very different ways. So, for example, Morgan Housel is a contributor to the book, and, you know, he had one perspective. Debbie Freeman, who's a prominent financial advisor based in Denver, you know, her life story is very different than anybody else in the volume. And she talked about, you know, the options that money can provide. So, you know, on the one hand, we had people talking about financial independence generally, but then how it was manifested was quite specific. You know, another consistent theme was the use of money in people's lives to take care of others. I mean, I think just about everybody's chapter, you know, talked about family, talked about community, in some cases talked about charity or philanthropy. And Cheryl Penny, who wrote a great chapter, founder of Dynasty Financial Partners, you know, he grew up in a pretty bad financial situation and has achieved unbelievable success and is giving back. And so he spends some time detailing kind of what he has been able to do for others. And a lot of people did that. And I found it pretty inspirational.
So I was also interested to see that many of the experts acknowledged that some of the decisions they'd made did not necessarily deliver the highest return on investment. So what lessons do you think people can take away from that about balancing return on investment with other considerations like peace of mind, like simplicity and expediency? How do you think people should approach their own finances with respect to balancing ROI and these other considerations?
You know, as you ask the question, it occurs to me for the first time that out of the 25 essays, not a single person mentioned whether or not they had beaten their benchmark. The S&P or the Dow or the MSCI World or 60-40 portfolio, you know, those are in the background in terms of some allocation decisions. But, you know, sort of maximizing returns, beating the market didn't really seem to take hold with any of these authors and financial experts. You know, so to your question and Jeff's question about financial independence, you know, people have a sense of the life they want to live. We're born into very, very different circumstances, one from another. And so figuring out how you want to underwrite, you know, whatever that vision is, how you want to match or map up your assets and liabilities, those end up being very personal decisions. And I think one of the motivations of the book from Josh and me was that, you know, we all know the textbook answers. We know what the efficient portfolio is. We know Fama French and we've read Markowitz and we get all that. But when even experts get into the weeds of just, okay, I've got kids, I've got parents, I've got a community, I've got, you know, aspirations that I'm striving for, you know, it is quite hard to map the formal theory to those subjective goals. And from what I've seen, the subjective goals win out every time. And one thing, you know, we really tried to do in the volume was have, you know, a wide diversity of voices. So, you know, folks are younger, folks are older, just a fair amount of diversity across multiple dimensions. And I think that brings perspective that we often don't get in the financial industry, which tends not to be particularly diverse.
What were some areas where the experts that contributed to the book tended to veer from conventional investing or financial planning wisdom?
I'd flag maybe a couple issues. One is maybe concentration risk. So I think what you saw in a number of chapters, I think if I recall correctly, you know, Josh Brown wrote about this. I think some others did as well. You know, sometimes we make investment decisions based in part on our relationships and wanting to support others. So people like Josh or me or Ted Seides or Howard Lindzen, and, you know, those are some of the names that come to mind right now. You know, you make a chunky investment in a venture that you believe in, not just because you've run the numbers and they look great, but because the people behind the project are important to you and you want to support them. And so as a result, you end up having chunkier positions, bigger positions than you might. A second, I don't know if it's unconventional wisdom, but the issue of debt and mortgages in particular. I think you saw a number of people in the volume out of the 25, maybe 5 or 6 people indicate that they had paid off their house. And especially given where rates are and how cheap debt is, you know, there's, a good technical argument for why you should keep that mortgage and you can reinvest that cash at a higher rate and effectively capture the spread between those two. You know, people, including me, have paid off their mortgage because it is a form of financial stability. It's a form of financial independence. It, frankly, it just feels good not to have that bill come due and also to have the sense that you own your home and the bank doesn't own your home. And it's something that you're going to have for as long as you want. I know there's, you know, long, sometimes interesting debates over whether people, you know, should have a mortgage. And if so, whether that should be, I'd say with this crowd, the conventional wisdom or the shared wisdom, not conventional, was that paying off a mortgage, if possible, produces some non-monetary benefits that are quite valuable.
So, Brian, we don't want to spend a ton of time drilling into how you invest your money. But one thing I was surprised about in reading through your essay was your discussion of some of these small private deals and ventures that you're invested in, what you described as lottery ticket investments. Can you talk about those, like how you find them and whether you would urge other people to do that with their own money?
Yeah, you know, it's a personal decision. And you know, let's start with where does it come from? And I think I pointed out in my chapter, I know Ted Seides pointed it out in his as well. You know, social capital and financial capital intersect in some interesting ways. And, you know, you, me, and Jeff, we've been in the industry for a long time. You meet people along the way who are doing interesting and potentially lucrative things. And so I think the more you hang out in our neck of the woods, you see investment opportunities come around. And, you know, that's been the case for me over the last 5 or 10 years. And some of them are not only interesting, they seem like they're good investments. But, you know, that term that you use, that I use in the chapter, lottery tickets, you know, venture capital, angel investing, very, very risky. I mean, these things aren't meant to make, you know, 10% a year for some number of years. You're looking to double or triple or 10x your money over the course of 5 or 8 years or some period of time, while at the same time risk losing it all. And so I think for an individual investor, they've got to be in a spot where they can lose that money. You know, it's really hard to put together a spreadsheet where you can estimate, you know, the probability that certain investments are going to end up in the money and make you multiples and that you're all in IRR across, you know, a portfolio of venture or angel investments is going to make you money. I think that's, I mean, you can make that spreadsheet, but it's completely fabricated and I wouldn't rely on it for anything. It's something that people should enter, I think, very carefully and be kind of financially prepared for most of those investments to go south.
If you had to universalize some of the key themes and lessons from the book for the broader investing public, including those who maybe aren't as well established financially or as far along in their careers as your contributors are, what would you cite as those key themes and lessons?
Sure. Yeah, there were a number of key themes that jumped out for me. And in fact, in the concluding chapter to the book, I walk through some of those. Among others, you know, I observe that, you know, money is very much an expression of our values and our identity. Now, that's not a dollars and cents personal finance observation, but I think, you know, including for, you know, folks that are just getting going with their investment career in their careers generally, appreciating that, you know, money is just not this numerical thing, but it's connected to who we are and who we want to be. And, you know, in the book, we had folks in their 20s, folks in their 60s, and people in between. So there was a pretty wide range of life experiences here. And virtually everybody wrote about how money fit into their broader story. So related to that, I would say money scripts matter. And what do I mean by money scripts? Like, these are the stories that we inherit or tell ourselves about money. Money could be seen as a bad thing, as a good thing. It's very much tied to our earlier childhood, you know, experiences. You know, one of the contributors, Blair Duquesne, who's a colleague of Josh's at Ritholtz Wealth, I mean, she tells an interesting story about her growing up where she did in the American South and where money fit into her family's decisions. Same thing with Nina O'Neill and Ashby Daniels and Leanne Miko. They all had scripts that, to some extent, were received as they were given from others. And then they had the chance to revise those scripts if they wanted. Last thing I'll mention, and there's a number of different themes, but last thing I'll mention, and it's a little bit more precise and related to personal finance, but that process matters, and there's no one right way to manage money. I mean, the podcast that you guys have put together, you talk to all these great portfolio managers, and it's a real rainbow of different colors, people just doing things different ways, but the best of the best have a process where, you know, they have mapped out the steps ahead of time. You know, yes, these chapters are at times emotional and they speak to people's identities, but you also find across all of them a certain process that the financial expert has put into play for how they're going to think about their short versus long-term goals, what the appropriate asset allocation is going to be, how they're going to express that allocation through stocks or bonds or funds or other vehicles, what they're rebalancing protocol might be, and so on and so forth. So one of the good things about, you know, our current community is through social media is that we can see so many different types of people pursue different types of processes. And because there's not one right way, but there's probably a right way for you, sampling all of that and putting something into place that feels right, something that you can stick with, is super important.
So switching over to your day job, you have a firm, Shaping Wealth, where your focus is financial wellness. And let's just talk about what that term means, because I think on the surface, it seems really vague and lots of people interpret it different ways. So how do you think about that?
Yeah. It's both vague and fashionable. So maybe that's a bad combination. I define it pretty specifically, and there's been some research or writing on the topic that I've leaned on. To me, financial wellness is a four-part experience, or financial wellness has four dimensions. And I would summarize those quickly as what I call, you know, sort of getting by, solving for emergencies, achieving goals, and funded contentment. And let me elaborate on each of those briefly. The getting by part, you know, the personal, which is sort of the day-to-day personal finance part of financial wellness, is being able to pay the bills. You know, we all have, you know, homes that we need to afford and transportation that we need to pay for and education and clothing and all the basic stuff. And as we know, for many people, that in and of itself is a struggle. And so, you know, financial wellness to me starts with just that ability to kind of cover your daily expenses, cover your monthly bills. Then there's more of a forward-looking covering your bills, which is, you know, sort of feeling safe, being prepared for emergencies. We also know that many people don't have just a few hundred bucks to solve a financial emergency if it would come. And so being able to have a rainy day fund is another form of financial wellness. Third, achieving goals sounds pretty straightforward. We want to do things like buy a home, send our kids to college. The big one is obviously retirement. So much of our industry is anchored on this notion of retirement. And, you know, those are all things in the future that we want to achieve or experience. And the ability to, you know, make a financial plan to achieve them is a critical pillar of financial wellness. And then there's this fourth issue or fourth dimension that I call funded contentment. It's a topic that I wrote about in some detail in The Geometry of Wealth, which was the last book that I authored. And To me, that's true wealth, which I define as the ability to underwrite a meaningful life. So beyond just achieving goals, so, you know, you want to retire with X number of dollars of income per month so you can support whatever lifestyle you want to lead. There's actually a, I would argue, a deeper form of being where we achieve contentment, you know, through connection to others, through our autonomy, through the flow or competence we express at work and so forth. Being able to afford the things that those provide for us, to me, is sort of the, you know, sort of the top of the Maslow's triangle of financial wellness, if you will.
In what ways has the pandemic influenced how you approach that topic of financial wellness? You listed off the four dimensions. And so I would imagine that the first two in that pecking order, getting by and solving for emergencies, there's probably a whole lot more attention that's being paid to those these days, given the fact that it's life's necessities that have become a challenge for many. So has that caused any sort of reevaluation in the way you approach your definition of financial wellness and the way others should?
It doesn't change the way I define financial wellness, but you're right to suggest that it perhaps changes priorities a little bit in the here and now. People are struggling. A lot of people are out of work, and people are struggling to pay the bills. And so what I've seen, especially from the corporate side of things, as those firms scramble themselves just to stay in business and do what needs to be done, this notion of financial wellness, financial well-being, financial health, it seems to be a topic that organizations and companies want to discuss more. I mean, I don't have a long time series on this, so it's hard to, you know, speak to a specific trend, but it's not at all difficult to raise this topic in an organizational context and have a CEO or head of HR or, you know, somebody in a leadership position say, we'd really like you to speak with our employees about some of the decisions that they need to make in the here and now. So, for example, I've given a number of talks over the last few months, all roughly with the title, you know, financial wellness during times of crisis or financial wellness during volatile times. And, you know, just giving people a vocabulary and a roadmap for the types of decisions that they might need to make. When crises happen, generally speaking, our sense of time collapses. And so, you know, we might have plans for 5, 10, 20 plus years from now, and that's good. But when there's the type of situation that we have faced over the last few months, it's easy for those plans to go a little bit out the window and we focus on being safe right here. That's front of mind for a lot of people, and it seems to have changed a little bit the demand for the type of coaching and content that, you know, I'm in the process of delivering.
So going back to that term funded contentment, I think that resonates with a lot of people. It resonates with me. But I think part of funding contentment is figuring out what makes you content. So yeah. Can you talk about how you help people approach that discovery process? Like, how do you do this?
Yeah, carefully. You know, it can be a sensitive topic because, you know, we can quickly move from, you know, sort of the numbers and formulas of finance, which in some strange way feel safe because they're so abstract, and get into, you know, true issues as to, well, what's the personal in personal finance? For me, there are four dimensions to funded contentment or four dimensions to a meaningful life. And, you know, I wrote about this at some length in The Geometry of Wealth. And, you know, it's based on, number one, just my life experience, but also, you know, spending a fair amount of time doing kind of directed research in philosophy and theology and psychology and seeing what common themes exist in terms of, you know, sources of contentment. So for me, there's four, and I call them the four C's: connection, control, competence, and context. The first one is human connection. We are hardwired as social beings. We don't just like to be around other people. We need to be around other people. We're sort of deeply tribal in nature, kind of small T tribal, not the nasty political capital T tribal that, you know, is sort of afoot right now. But we travel in packs, and we like to be around others. It gives us a sense of safety. It also gives us a sense of purpose. So that need for belonging is arguably our most important source of contentment. You know, on the other hand, we've got control, or we could say autonomy, that sense that, you know, you're living the life that you want to lead. And, you know, you're not being controlled by others. You can set your own course and you can tell your own story. And that pursuit of freedom, liberty, opportunity is very definitional of who we are. And when we don't have it, we feel worse and we feel smaller. The third form of contentment is what I call competence. We might also call it mastery. It's the notion that, you know, work or our vocation or hobbies are sort of deeply important to who we are. I mean, especially in America, when you go to a party or a conference and, you know, the first thing someone asks you is, well, what do you do? And, you know, spoiler alert, they don't really care what you do. What they care about is who you are. They want to have some sense of your identity. And we know, you know, from our occupations that going into jobs, leaving jobs, just the day-to-day of work very much impacts our sense of self-worth. And then finally, you know, the fourth C is what I call context, which is sort of a broader, all-encompassing notion that people who live for something beyond themselves seem to tend to be happier, and that there are some long-standing and deep-seated sources of that connection to something bigger than ourselves. I think the obvious one is faith and religion. That is so critically important to who people are. But there's also place, you know, nation, community, hometown. Those things are meaningful to us. But there's other things as well. I, you know, often talk about sports teams. Both of you guys know I'm kind of a rabid Pittsburgh Steelers fan and part of Steelers Nation. And, you know, I guess on one hand, it's trivial. On the other hand, it's meaningful to me. I mean, it speaks to my roots. It speaks to, you know, positive memories of growing up in Pittsburgh. And, you know, I'm connected to that community, at least in the virtual sense. So these aren't quantitative categories. You're not supposed to or even think about rank ordering these. You know, they don't go from 1 to 10. And if you get, you know, 10 on each, so 40 out of 40, you're like super content. It doesn't really work that way. There are some nuances and some contradictions and conflicts between these sources of contentment. But, you know, being able to raise these issues in a financial advice context is where I think some of the most interesting and exciting wealth management is taking place right now.
We're going to talk about financial advice in a moment. Before we did so, I was just curious if somebody was sort of doing a self-audit of sorts, asking themselves, am I financially well or am I on the path to financial wellness? You've laid out these four dimensions. How would they go about that process? What would they want to ask themselves? And then based on those answers, what would they want to do with that information?
Yeah, I think the nice thing about the framework is that it lends itself to some pretty practical exercises. So, you know, we've got four categories, and each of them is distinct enough for its own blank sheet of paper. You know, so on the idea of just getting by, being able to pay the bills, I mean, that's a budget. That's cash flow analysis. That's balance sheet, having a sense of what you own versus what you owe, assets versus liabilities. You know, there's work that you can do with an advisor. There's work that you can do with online tools like Mint, or You Need a Budget, or so many different things that we have on offer these days. But, you know, sort of the getting by part is very much sort of personal finance basics, you know, 101. The feeling safe or feeling protected piece, I mean, that's thinking, in the bigger picture, it's thinking holistically about risk. It's, hey, what could go wrong in the future? And is there anything I can do now to make sure that doesn't happen? Or if it does happen, the damage that comes is minimized. You know, the obvious point is insurance. You know, we think about sort of the huge impact of low probability events, and we want to pay or buy insurance of one form or another to make sure that that doesn't happen. But, you know, managing risk isn't just with our financial capital, it's also with our human and social capital. So we want to think about, you know, our skill set and keeping that fresh over time, about kind of our network and our relationships. The third exercise or blank piece of paper is goals achievement. And what are the things that you want to do in the future? You know, it could be a certain type of vacation. It could be a certain quality of retirement. It's whatever you want. And then thinking about the cash flow or assets that would be necessary to afford those things in the future. So again, you know, not always easy, but in some ways a pretty straightforward financial planning exercise. And then the fourth, which is probably the hardest to execute, but I would argue is sort of the most meaningful, is taking those four sources of contentment seriously: connection, control, competence, and context, and doing some work by yourself or with others to figure out what those are and what the kind of financial implications of belonging to a particular community are, or having, you know, in the control column, you know, having a firm say over kind of where your life is going to go and not being vulnerable to the whims of others. I would argue that's a little bit more complicated, but I think it's time well spent.
I have a two-part question about financial advice. So the first part is, do you think that this whole your word funded contentment, your term funded contentment, helping individuals find their aspirations, their life's purpose, do you think that's the next evolution of financial advice? And then I guess another question is, and you and I have discussed this a little bit offline, Brian, but you know, do you think that some firms are using it as a little bit of a marketing gimmick? I've been concerned because it's it's begun to be kind of a drumbeat recently.
Yeah, maybe I'm a drum beater. So let me answer the first question first. And the history matters here. You know, it's easy to kind of just get wrapped up with where we are right now. But, you know, the wealth management industry hasn't been around really for all that long. So going back more than 30 or 40 years, you had a brokerage business. Now that's existed for centuries. And that's just buying and selling of securities. And until, you know, the 80s and 90s, capital markets access was not something that was easy or cheap. And, you know, that began to change in the 90s with E-Trade and Schwab. And, you know, fast forward to today, you can basically buy, you know, thousands of different securities online effectively for free. It's a sort of a night and day experience. So the wealth management industry has sort of evolved as technology and consumer preferences have evolved. It was a brokerage business of just selling things. And then advisors evolved into investors and allocators, meaning that they not just gave, you know, said, hey, you should buy IBM here or Pfizer there. They began to assemble portfolios. Beyond that, then there was another phase that started maybe 10, 15 years ago of true financial planning, where it wasn't, hey, here's a good portfolio of investments, but this is a portfolio of investments that is tied to whatever your goals are in the short, medium, and long term. The challenge along the way is that, and this is true of every industry, things get commoditized. You know, brokerage got commoditized. The, you know, access to a diversified portfolio, that's become commoditized. You know, now in the world of planning, there are lots of entrants, Vanguard and Schwab among them, who can put together a very credible financial plan for very, very cheap. And so the question is, well, what do financial advisors do to justify what's typically a very premium fee? And one answer, and it's not the only answer, and it's actually the wrong answer for some people, is that there's an evolution in the industry toward coaching. I'm not sure if that's exactly the right word. Maybe it's just helping, but you know, the world is just a very noisy place. We're dealing with more information and more choice than at any point before in recorded history. And you know, financial advisors, in my experience, having met thousands of them over the years, are very interested in just helping their clients lead better lives, helping to navigate difficult decisions. So I do think that, you know, for some advisors in certain contexts, evolving from broker to investor to planner to coach is a pretty natural flow. But like you alluded to, as we've discussed offline, that's not necessarily the right move for everybody, because it's not necessarily going to be authentic. So the short answer to your second question is that it could be BS. I mean, it could be just a marketing spin. But at the same time, I know so many advisors who are so vested in a genuine sense in the lives of their clients, that there are additional tools that we get from positive psychology, behavioral finance, decision science, the coaching field, that those have only just begun to be introduced to this industry. And there's no reason that if we do want to coach our clients to lead better lives generally that we can afford, that we wouldn't avail of ourselves the best insights and technology that are out there.
You alluded to it before, but there's the potential for a skill mismatch. It's possible that some investment advisors who are very much at home discussing things like, you know, bond convexity or Sharpe ratios or maybe Roth conversion, stretch IRA, you name it, are less comfortable sitting down to discuss their clients' aspirations. And so, you know, based on the work that you've done with advisors and the conversations you've had, how do they sort of skill up or evolve as they'll need to in order to stay relevant to these clients?
Yeah, that's a good, it's a really good question. And there's, I mean, Jeff, there's a sample bias in who I talk to, because I'm not, you know, I'm not interested in converting. I'm more interested in selling Bibles. So if someone wants to be a stockbroker and they think all of this financial coaching stuff is goofy and silly, that's totally fine. I'm not going to try to convince them to be somebody that they're not. The challenge is neither the hardcore broker who just wants to be wheeling and dealing in the market, nor is it the financial therapist who, you know, literally and figuratively puts their clients on the couch to talk about deep-seated issues. It's everybody in the middle who is in one way or another pursuing something called goals-based wealth management. And to, you know, Christine's point or question just a moment ago, you know, that phrase, quote unquote, goals-based wealth management was sort of invented by some big wirehouse firms who wanted a different wrapper for the same old sales jargon. So if an advisor is interested in talking with their clients about bond convexity and, you know, particular diversification strategies or sector rotation, I think number one, there's a decent chance the client has literally no idea what they're talking about. I don't know many individuals who go to a financial advisor because they basically want a pocket portfolio manager. Maybe some do, but that doesn't seem to be the case in my experience. And that's probably even more true from a generational shift perspective. I think that's more of an old school way of thinking about things. Bottom line, there are going to be some people who, you know, pursue a deeper, more sophisticated conversation about goals and objectives, and there are going to be others who just kind of use those as, you know, placeholders to sell the right products. And I'm not trying to make it sound like one's wrong versus right. I mean, I have a preference, obviously, but I think authenticity is absolutely critical in all of this. To me, the modern advisor is aspirational, adaptive, and authentic. They have an orientation toward growth. They're not just in a legacy business. They're willing to accept that the world is unpredictable and they're going to change with things. And then finally, they're going to just be who they are to their clients and not try to be somebody else, because people can pick up on that almost immediately. To me, one of the cool things about the wealth management industry is that it's so large. There are so many advisors and so many clients and potential clients that everything is on offer. And, you know, just a matter of mapping up people with like minds who can do good work together.
You've spent a lot of time on behavioral finance over the past decade or more. Do you think that too much of the behavioral finance discussion focuses around investing and investing mistakes? And is it broader? And if so, you know, what do you think are some of the key under-tilled, under-discussed areas in behavioral finance?
Yeah, I love this question because the discipline is evolving in some really interesting ways. And I would say, you know, we are in or entering what I call behavioral finance 2.0. I mean, we all know the backstory, the Undoing Project, Kahneman and Tversky, and it's a great story. And then Thaler sort of ports it over to economics. You're completely right, Christine, that this has been, by and large, a conversation about the psychology of investing for the last two or three decades, as distinct from the psychology of money more broadly defined. So I work with this concept that I call money life, which has seven dimensions. And investing is one of them, but there's also earning, saving, spending, borrowing, protecting, giving. All seven of those dimensions have psychological contours. All seven of them we can do better or worse. And among other trends in, I'll call it applied behavioral finance, or maybe I should put it differently. I'd say behavioral finance 1.0 is kind of conceptual or theoretical. Behavioral finance 2.0 is applied behavioral finance. I mean, probably the number one question I've gotten in all the lectures and meetings I've done and reactions to, books written. And I know, friends like Daniel Crosby have had the same experience, which is, you talk about confirmation bias or anchoring and all that stuff, which is interesting. But then the question is, well, how do I use this in my practice? How do I become a better advisor or a better investor as a result of it? And so, this new world of applied behavioral finance, I think what it's going to do is it's going to focus in part on non-investment areas, especially saving, spending, borrowing, charity, and look at sort of better and worse decisions, as well as habits. So there's a lot of interesting work being done in decision sciences. Generally, I've been really lucky to sit on the advisory board of something called the Alliance for Decision Education, which was, founded by Annie Duke some years ago. And, helping people make better decisions, evaluate their options, do pre-mortems, post-mortems, things like that, appreciating that there's a difference between making a good decision and having a good habit, and then on top of that, recognizing that a better habit is preferable to a better decision because the habit is less taxing on our brains. I think all of this in the years to come, and we're really at the beginning stages, is going to be introduced to the general population, but really the wealth management industry specifically, where we're focused on the seven dimensions of money life and not just investing. And we can help people make better decisions and form better habits than they would otherwise. It's actually something that excites me as much as anything going on out there because it's so practical. If done properly, it's relatable and makes a true impact in people's lives.
I want to go back to what you referred to as, I think you called it behavioral finance 2.0 or applied behavioral. Mm-hmm. What do you consider to be the biggest breakthrough that you've seen in practice, in industry, where they've gone and applied some of these concepts and it's conferred manifold benefits on investors, savers, and the like?
So the answer that I want to give, I think, is relatively well known, but the impact has been so large that it can't be ignored. And that's the use of default options and nudges in the retirement savings space. So you've got programs like Save More Tomorrow that, have effectively kind of flipped the script on the way people had been saving and allocating to their 401ks or other employer retirement programs. And by changing the default option from not invest to invest, and then you can opt out, so you haven't lost any freedom or choice in the process. It's just your starting point is different. You guys might know, there's some gargantuan number in the tens or hundreds of billions of additional savings that have been created as a result of helping people form better habits. The nice thing about good habits is that we don't have to think about them. I mean, I don't think many of us think about brushing our teeth in the morning and the evening. We just go ahead and do it. It doesn't require any brain energy. And as a result, it's just something that we do. Beyond that, I do think we're kind of at the early stages. There are now technologies through apps and other programs where, you can be nudged to save a little bit more, or you can kind of round up on a bill and put that extra change to work in a savings context. I think what we see now is a pretty wide but not very deep set of experiments as to how we get people to make better decisions and form better habits. And there are some green shoots, and I think there's some early success, like Save More Tomorrow. And, hopefully there's going to be a lot more to come.
We recently did a podcast interview with John Lynch at the University of Colorado last year, and it was controversial. He shared some research where he found that these broad-based financial literacy efforts in his research do not necessarily lead to better outcomes. So I guess my question is, do you agree with that general thesis? And how do you think financial education, whether you're delivering it or whether it's being delivered in schools, how can it be better? What are some of the things that it can embed to lead to better outcomes?
Important topic. And yeah, I listened to the John Lynch interview very closely. And, you know, I very much disagree with his perspective. I feel like he was delivering a set of views that are quite dated, you know, in some cases relying on studies that are 5, 10, 15 years old that I think are recognized by some to be poorly designed and poorly executed. And so you've got, you know, other experts like Anne-Marie Lusardi, who I follow closely, and I feel like her and Carly Urban and, you know, my friends at the University of Chicago Financial Education Initiative, and we can get into the details of what we mean by financial education. So, you know, they're not just priming the pump to prove that something called financial education works. But if you get granular and you look at the decisions that, you know, in this case, young adults make with regard to debt, saving, spending, and so forth, a lot of the current research that's been published over the last several years seems to suggest relatively strongly that interventions in the schoolroom, giving people a sense of what their choice set is, what these concepts mean, I would argue they actually make an enormous difference in people's lives. Now, I think we can put a big asterisk on that because the serious scholarship on financial literacy isn't that old, and we'll see what the long-term effects are. But, you know, in my travels and my guess, given, you know, what both of you guys do for a living, you hear this as well. I mean, the demand for practical financial education is everywhere. Financial advisors would like to deliver that to their clients, not just the children of their clients, but, you know, older individuals as well. You know, when you teach students these topics on saving and spending and borrowing, you know, they seem to enjoy it. And like I said, there are some measurably positive impacts on the decisions that they make. So, yeah, I was really quite disappointed with John's perspective because, number one, I think it's empirically inaccurate. But number two, from a, you know, mission-based perspective, this is something that we need to do. You know, to the earlier conversation about financial wellness and just, you know, on the ground floor of being able to pay the bills, you know, use debt wisely. These aren't intuitive. You know, our brain isn't wired to make great decisions on these topics. And so people need help. And for as much as we've been talking about financial literacy and financial education in this country for quite some time, you know, here too, you know, under that, maybe that big umbrella of behavioral finance 2.0 or applied behavioral finance, I think the opportunity to change people's lives by introducing them to these concepts, by teaching them how to ask the right questions in the right context, just critically important.
So just to follow up, I did feel that his comments about kind of point of purchase financial education or like getting the education closer to decision time made a lot of sense and had a ring of truth. I mean, I'm sure you, like us, have sat in front of high school kids and tried to teach them about asset allocation because that's what you're supposed to do. I mean, there's something that has a ring of truth to it that if people are in no position to use the guidance that you're giving them, why are you doing it, right?
Yeah, I don't know why someone would be teaching 17-year-olds about asset allocation or really investing generally. I mean, I don't know if I'm – well, I can say whatever I want, I suppose. Like, I don't see the point in teaching kids about investing beyond buying a target date fund or just a basket of index funds. I mean, the sexy part is Robinhood. The sexy part is, you know, betting on a Tesla or whatever. And that's fine. And that's not investing. That's gambling. Let's call it what it is. And it's fine. Want to go to the casino and gamble, you should. But, you know, to me, real financial literacy and financial education centers on understanding what key concepts are, and especially in the world of saving, spending, credit cards, college debt, those are all, I mean, to John's point, I guess, is nominally fine, you know, the point of sale or point of purchase type advice. I think because the topic is so broad and so complicated and frankly, unbelievably overwhelming and intimidating, even to people who have a lot of money, this is an intimidating topic. We know that through academic studies, but I also know that from meeting thousands of investors, some of whom who have tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, and they're overwhelmed with what all of this means. So, you know, teeing people up to feel comfortable, to ask questions is, I think, critically important and also not mutually exclusive. So, you know, if you're going to take out a loan or, you know, purchase a mortgage or buy a car or take out loans for college, whatever the situation is, of course, there's nothing wrong with having point of sale advice. But if you haven't sort of primed younger folks, young adults, to know that it's even legitimate to ask those questions, because many people are just afraid to ask the question. They don't want to look stupid. They don't want to feel stupid. I think that they're sort of a hand in glove thing. You need to set a basic framework, and then you need to give people tools at the times that they need it.
You have three teenage children. What's your advice to parents who are listening who would like their kids to become wiser with money?
What follows on from exactly what I was just talking about, Jeff, I mean, you know, we'll see if my teenage kids actually make good decisions in the years to come. But, you know, maybe I'll answer the question through the lens of the word transparency. My wife and I are reasonably transparent about the decisions that we need to make financially, related to their college, to a mortgage, to investments that I make or could make. And, you know, not treating it like it's a classroom. You know, we don't have a chalkboard or a whiteboard in the house where I'm scribbling things. Sometimes I wish I had one. But, you know, including them to the extent that it's comfortable and responsible in understanding the different types of things that we need to figure out, you know. So to this issue of money life, you know, what does it mean for mom and dad to have a salary? How do we think about, you know, spending less than we make and saving the proceeds? And what do we do with those savings, you know, short-term versus long-term? I think maybe part of it is just creating a healthy atmosphere where these issues are not taboo and that they can come up and, you know, including them in the process a little bit, you know, again, in a comfortable and responsible way. So, you know, we love travel. We take nice vacations from time to time. And we include the kids in the process of choosing the things that we want to do, not just from an activities perspective, but from a cost perspective. And, you know, I think it's a, you know, sort of a teaching moment to say, we've got, you know, these two options. We could do an activity on this day and we can do A or we can do B. A is super cool, but it costs, you know, five times what B costs. I'm making stuff up right now, obviously. But, you know, what do you guys think? And just have them chime in. So making it a topic that they're not afraid to engage in, you know, to Christine's point about Lynch's point about point of purchase advice, create, you know, young adults who are comfortable asking uncomfortable questions when they need to. I hope that works out.
Well, Brian, this has been a really enjoyable and illuminating discussion. Thanks so much for having it with us and our listeners. We really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, guys. Always nice.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Thanks for joining us on The Long View. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to and rate The Long View for Morningstar on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can follow us on Twitter at Christine_Benz.
And at SYouth1, which is SYOUTH and the number one. Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Jeff Patak is an employee of Morningstar Research Services, LLC. Morningstar Research Services is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.